Tom, welcome to Boise.
Thanks for having me.
So we are not exactly on the beaten path. Is this your first time here and or in Idaho?
It is not my first time in Idaho. It's not my first time here, but it's the first time I've stopped here. Last time I came through, I went up to the mountain somewhere to do a show for some very wealthy skiing people. And I also performed in Idaho Falls, which I didn't come through here to get to, but I did Idaho Falls. But this is my first time performing in Boise.
Well, first impressions.
I like it. I just, you know, it's so funny. When I come from Los Angeles, I'm originally from the East Coast, but I'm living in Los Angeles now. And it always seems nice. Like there's palm trees and there's sunshine and it's very, you know, it seems like a healthy place. And then you come to a place like this and you're like, oh, this is what clean air is. We don't have clean air. It's so different. I just...
You're telling me you trust air that you can't see?
Yeah. It's really... it's beautiful. First impression's beautiful. I went to a hipster coffee shop this morning. They were all friendly. And now I'm with you, so it's going well so far.
It can only go up.
What should I look out for? What's the trouble spots?
It's Idaho. Everywhere is generally pleasant.
Yeah, it is. Good audience.
So we recently chatted when you appeared on our talk show, Idaho Matters. You said that in spite of a book and TV shows and your gig as the head writer and the wayfaring correspondent on Live From Here, that stand-up is still your first love. Can you just sort of walk me through what do you feel when you get out there on stage? What is it? Is it electricity? Is it a fear? What goes through your mind?
Yeah, it's very, it's kind of all those things. It makes you feel very alive because you know... Look, you go to a show, like you go see a Broadway show or something, or a band. There's a lot going on stage. You know, if the bass player drops his pick or if the drummer, you know, throws up, they'll get through it. There's enough people to keep the show alive. But when I walk out, that's it. It's just, I'm the show. I'm the one, I'm the only thing that's happening. So if anything can happen, if I don't do well, if I throw up, it could be a very unpleasant show.
That's why there's always a bucket by you.
Yeah, so I think that that's kind of at its heart, is that it's not high risk, but it feels high risk. Like we all know, like, this is very alive, it's very in the moment, and anything can go right and anything can go wrong. Not that it's like watching, you know, NASCAR, and you're waiting for the crash. But it is very alive, and I think that energy is it something that's become addictive to me.
Is it a stress, or is it something that you feed off of?
It's a tension. There's definitely a tension. But I've been doing this a long time, and I'm really good at it. So I'm not
keep,
that
keep tooting the horn.
I'm not that afraid of like, but still, you know, even if you jump out of a plane. You know, your first time, you're going to be really freaked out, which I was when I first did stand up. And now, after, you know, helping all these people jump out of planes and flying tandem with them, I know what I'm doing. But still, when you step from the plane, you're going to feel it. There's going to be a jolt to your system.
Now, you performed on Colbert, you performed on Conan, all these things. But I mean, mm-hmm. have you still, even at this level, just gone out and just totally tanked one night and it's... It's an outlier, certainly, but you're just like, what happened?
Yeah, it's only if I'm like at the Comedy Store in L.A. or the Comedy Cellar in New York, you know, when I'm there just to work on new stuff. Mm-hmm. And it could just be weird. It could be weird energy. And then I'm just trying some stuff that's, you know, not great yet. That's as close as I'll get to bombing. And it's still uncomfortable.
You can test anything new out here in Idaho, Cosmopolitan Center?
I think it's really important that every show is different. I to use a Broadway analogy again, I'm not doing Cats. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to just go out there and I think the audience senses it. I can sense it. It's like, you know, this. I don't want to just go through the words. So I talk to the audience. I'm throwing new lines in all the time. So it makes it alive. It puts me on edge. It makes the thing more present. So, yeah, there'll be a couple snuck in. Nothing wholesale, though.
All right. Well, Let's switch gears and go back to some of your myriad jobs. Let's talk a little bit about Live From Here. It's the successor to the public radio rock of Gibraltar, Prairie Home Companion.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Prairie Home Live From Here, it's all about music. It's got that sort of an appreciation for small town values, and it's, you know, generally a little folksy.
Yeah.
So why do you think that still resonates today? Why do people still show up to the radio to listen to something like that when we're bombarded with our digital life?
I think that's it. I think that's probably a big part of it, and I think it's probably what the appeal was even before we had these smartphones attached to our faces. It's a respite. It's a place. Like, you know, people listen to you. Your radio station is a destination. It's like going to a place, and you have all this noise and all this stuff, but they know when they tune into you that they're going to feel a certain way. They're comfortable here. This is a place that they've been before. They've hung out with you. They like it there. And I think that's the same thing with Live From Here. It just, there's a lot going on, there's a lot of chaos, but you know, NPR, you know, public radio is an oasis in this river of garbage.
we're going to use all of this in our pledge drive.
You really should. I you know, everywhere I go, that's what even before I had this gig, that's what I would always listen to. And it calms you down. There's like a little rationality. There's just a little less noise. It's a good place to be. So I think what Garrison did was, you know, took that to another level, because it was so small. Prairie Home Companion was such a, you know, that was like you're in a cabin in the woods. That was really slow, to the point where some people were passing out. Yeah, so so this is like an updated version of it, and the music is amazing, the comedy's strong, so I'm really happy doing it.
Well, part of the show is your segment Out in America. You like to point out some of the eccentricities of the places that you stop around the country. Where was a place that just sort of knocked your socks off with how unexpectedly funny or offbeat it was?
That's a good question. I mean, a lot of it. The real thing is not the place as much as the people that you run into, the people that you meet. Like, I had this one in Cleveland where, you know, it's Cleveland. I like Cleveland. I perform there a lot. But it's Cleveland. There's only so much you can write about the place. It's the people that you meet. And I had this driver met me. She was an African-American woman with her hair was like 12 feet high and these giant nails. And it was just one of those, she picked me up at baggage claim and just put her arm around me and was like, come on, honey, come with me. And she walked me into her car and did a 20-minute monologue about her chihuahuas, which she called her chihuahuas, and that they're all bougie, everything's bougie. She just went on a rant for 20 minutes, and I was it. My whole piece was written.
To be so lucky.
Yeah. You know, it's really been fun is that, you know, I travel a lot, so when I'm on the road all the time, as a young comedian, I would just put my earphones on and just zone out and just try and shut the world out a little bit. Now that I'm doing this monologue, which is, you know, focusing on people out there, any annoying person on the plane, any like jackass at in line at Starbucks, earphones are out and I am listening. I'm eavesdropping and stealing and putting it into my monologue.
Taking acute notes of every terrible person you encounter.
Yeah, it really made travel so much better. I'm like, all right, if you're going to be the one woman yapping away at 6 a.m. on a flight when everyone else wants to sleep, and I would want to wring your neck before it. Now I take out my pad. I jot down the thing she's saying. And it's like a work expense.
So at this point, you're just a collection of other people's grievances.
Yeah, and there's a lot of them.
Well, let's go a totally different direction as we sort of wrap up. Something people might not be familiar with is that you are indeed a baker and an adamant lover of bread.
Yes.
You even have a show. You have a show called Baked, mm-hmm. where you go around the country and you get to eat bread and baked goods. So I'm guessing not afraid of carbs or worried about gluten.
No, not at all. I don't understand why we are the first generation after thousands of years that's being told that bread is evil. Like, that never made sense to me. I'm like, wait a minute. People have been living on bread since ancient Egypt, and enjoying their lives. And now we show up and they're like, no, you can't eat it. Something's wrong. So as I started learning about it, what I realized was we're not eating real bread. We're not eating real bread. You go to these supermarkets and you buy like the whole wheat thing with the wooden sign that looks all nice for your family. And look at the side of it. It's like 30 ingredients. It's not bread. The FDA actually had to change the definition of bread so they could make the regulations on what bread was. Bread is flour, water, salt, and yeast. That's it. Nothing else. Maybe you'll throw in some sugar, maybe some egg if you're making bagels or whatever. But flour, water, salt, and yeast. If people make that for you, and there's great places even here in your town that really make it that way, it breaks down the sugars before you even eat it. There is gluten in it, but I really believe that a lot of the problems that people have is the other stuff added to the gluten. I think purely, I've had friends that eat my bread that have gluten problems and don't have a problem with it. That's not to say people have real problems, they do, but as this majority thing, when people are searching and trying to wonder why they feel sick, it's because we're being poisoned by all of this horrible stuff. So when I started making bread, I wasn't looking for a hobby. I wasn't like, someone just gave me some sourdough starter and I started doing it and I got really into it. And when my family was enjoying it and the house is filled with this great smell of baked bread, and then I realized we're not getting fat from it, we're enjoying it. I was right. We can eat bread. We should be allowed to eat bread. And and now it's taken over my life.
Does this love of bread conflict with your residency in Los Angeles at all?
You know, it's interesting because I have, LA is like the epicenter of whiny, skinny people. And, you know, to the point where if you're in a restaurant and you say yes, like with a gamma hand, would you like some bread? They don't just bring it out because they've gotten yelled at so many times. So like, would you like some bread? And you say yes. They like light up. There's a bread eater here. Get the one basket and bring it to the man on table 5. But I started making bagels, and I'm getting really good at it. So for the first time, I've been playing around with the idea of like, could we open a, like, there's such awful bagels in LA. Like, what if we were to open a bagel shop? And you have to consider, would these people eat the bagels or not in LA? But they do. They're kind of like, it's an anorexic city, you know. They're like, they'll binge on it and then, you know, not eat the rest of the day. But there's cupcake shops that thrive. I don't know. I'm thinking about it. And I really feel like, I feel like an Italian grandmother in LA. Like, in an Italian grandmother, I grew up Italian. They always look at you, no matter what size you are, they're like, you're fading away. You need to eat. Look at you. You're skin and bones. Eat, eat, eat. That's how I feel when I'm with people in L.A. One of the worst Thanksgivings I ever had was my first time in L.A. when I hosted and had all my L.A. friends come over and nobody ate. It's like, oh, I can't eat the pie. Oh, I can't eat this. I was like, well.
You're missing the entire point of the holiday.
Right, exactly. I have to find some East Coast friends, and you guys have to leave.
Well, Tom Papa, thank you so much for dropping by. We can't wait to see you tonight performing at the Egyptian. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, people love the Egyptian Theater. I have some comedian friends. My good buddy Ryan Hamilton just hit me last night, and he was excited that I was coming through. Everybody seems to really like that spot, so I'm psyched to start our relationship. Hopefully it'll go well, and I'll keep coming back.
All right, Tom Papa at the Egyptian Theater tonight in Boise starts at 8. Thanks again for coming by.
Thanks for having me.